KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, are smartphones making teens unhappy? Jean Twenge seems to think so. She's the psychologist from San Diego State University who has been studying generational differences for 25 years and has written such books as Generation Me and The Narcissism Epidemic. Twenge joins us to talk about her new book, and the title says it all, iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. We get started with Jean Twenge after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. According to San Diego State psychologist Jean Twenge, it's not an exaggeration to describe the generation born between 1995 and 2012 as being on the brink of the worst mental health crisis in decades, and she traces that deterioration to their phones. She calls this group iGen, a generation that has only known life with the internet. And she describes what makes this post-millennial generation unique in her new book, iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and what that means for the rest of us. Welcome to Forum, Jean Twenge.
Thank you.
You've written that teens who spend more time than average on screens are more likely to be unhappy, and those who spend more time than average on non-screen activities are more likely to be happy. It's really that clear cut.
Well, you know, I've been doing research on generational differences for about 25 years, and I keep an eye on these very large national surveys that are done of teens every year. And right around 2012, I started to see some pretty sudden big changes in depression, in suicide risk factors. CDC data showed suicide rates going up. So that made me wonder what was going on, that there was such a sudden large change in teens' moods and mental health. Well, I found out later, 2012 just happens to be the year when the percentage of Americans with a smartphone crossed 50%. So that made me wonder if that was a coincidence or not. So I dug further into those big surveys and found, as you describe, that on these surveys, they ask about how teens spend their time, and they ask how happy they are and if they're feeling symptoms of depression. And pretty much, pretty starkly, it was very surprising how stark this was. Pretty much everything that teens do that's not on a screen, like spending time with friends in person or exercising or sleeping or going to religious services, all of those things are correlated with more happiness and less depression. Pretty much everything that you can do on a screen, watching TV, being on social media, texting, being online, playing games online, all of those are correlated with less happiness and more depression.
So you feel like it's one single device that can really define a generation, given all the other factors that can contribute to defining a generation, from, you know, the types of major events that occur or even parenting styles, things like that?
Well, obviously, yes, historical events and parenting styles have a pretty big impact on this generation as well. And that shows up in, you know, many of their other characteristics. But for these mental health trends, my best guess is that most of that is probably due to the smartphone, simply because of these links with happiness and mental health. And because of the timing, right around 2011 or 2012, that was after the Great Recession was over, the economy was improving. But then there was this sudden change where, for example, between 2011 and 2015, the percentage of teens with clinical level depression increased by 50% in a national screening study. And there has to be an explanation for that. And smartphones seem to be the only thing that really fits.
Wow. And so is it just screen time, or is it what they're looking at on their screens? For example, if they're bombarded with, you know, messages about unrealistic levels of success or body image, things like that.
So in these surveys, they're just asking about the amount of time that teens spend, say, on social or texting or online. And they don't even really get into the details of exactly what teens are doing online. But it seems clear from other research that social media, for example, that it really is anxiety-producing in a lot of ways. Teens are waiting for likes. Sometimes there's cyberbullying. They can often feel very left out because, you know, it used to be when you weren't invited to the party, you might hear about it on Monday at school. Now you can see the pictures on Instagram.
Of everybody having fun without you, essentially.
Exactly.
It sounds also like this really boils down to the fact that screens take away from just social interaction and underscores the point that we are social creatures and that we need that to feel happy.
Exactly. And so that was one of the other trends that really popped out to me in looking at these big surveys of teens is they ask how much time teens spend just hanging out with their friends, going to parties, driving around in a car just for fun, going to the mall. And millennials started this trend, you know, when with internet access in the 2000s, with spending less time with their friends in person. But then right around 2010, 2011, the age of the smartphone, it just falls off a cliff. The percentage of teens who, for example, are getting together with their friends every day, or the number of times per week teens say that they go out with their friends. And it's a really, really striking pattern. And, you know, again, it happens right at the same time as the smartphone. And I think that's one of the keys here. It's not just screens. So even if we set aside any negative effect of screens and call it a neutral, teens are spending, depending on the survey, 6 to 8 hours a day on average with screens. That, just during their leisure time, that's an enormous amount of time. And that, more than likely, is crowding out the time they used to spend with their friends in person, which we know is one of the keys to mental health and happiness. That could be the entire effect, potentially, of the smartphone, is if it is replacing in-person, face-to-face social interaction, which is so beneficial.
We're talking with San Diego State University psychology professor Jean Twenge about the effect of smartphones on the generation that has only known life with the internet. It's created some interesting characteristics, Jean Twenge, of this group. One that you note is that they go out on fewer dates, and maybe a benefit of that is actually that there's they're not having sex at an early age so much.
Right. So this is part of a bigger trend that goes beyond just smartphones into parenting styles and an overall cultural change in how we raise our kids. So these days we have fewer kids. We nurture them more carefully. We expect that they'll go to college. We expect they're going to have their own kids later, that they'll start adulthood later, possibly because people live longer now. And it's a real contrast to, say, the baby boomer era, when the average woman had four kids and there weren't as many labor-saving devices. And so kids just, they played on their own and they were much more independent at a much earlier age. So this big shift has meant that teens are growing up more slowly. So not only are they less likely to date or to have sex or get pregnant as teenagers, they're also less likely to drive, to have a paid job during high school, to drink alcohol. And the one thing that really explains all those trends is growing up more slowly, taking longer to engage in both the pleasures and the responsibilities of adulthood. And many of those trends are things parents obviously are going to think are wonderful, like less sex and less drinking. Others don't fit clearly into that lens of just good or bad, like driving and working. And I think you miss a lot when you just put things into those bins of good or bad. Instead, seeing that whole picture of development slowing down really allows a better view of iGen and how they're growing up during their teen years.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join the conversation because you've already raised a lot of interesting points that I think that they'd like to weigh in on. Give us a call with your questions for Jean Twenge about iGen. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. You can tweet us at kqedforum and post your comments on Facebook. Jean Twenge, one of the things that you wrote about was how, yes, the distinct difference between your generation and this generation, in the sense that you couldn't wait. I mean, your 16th birthday was the day that you went and got your driver's license, right? And how important that was for you in terms of the independence. So do you think that this lack of independence has, what kind of long-term effects do you feel like it has?
Well, I think that remains to be seen a little bit, but I think some of the effects are already showing up. So iGen is arriving at college and in the workplace with less experience with independence, less experience making their own decisions, and that can be potentially problematic. With the millennials, just before iGen, we're seeing this as well. So, for example, adulting is now a verb, and it's used to describe usually things that nobody wants to do, like doing laundry and going to work and so on. And if you follow this online, you'll see that there are these memes that say things like done adulting, which I find particularly fascinating because really you're done adulting. So what are you going to do? Go back to being a child? How exactly is that going to work?
And that's what you mean when you say that this group in your title is completely unprepared for adulthood?
So that's certainly part of it, that there's so many advantages to our kids not growing up before they're ready. And there's so many advantages to them being safe. iGen is arguably the safest generation in American history, at least physically so. But there are upsides and downsides to every cultural change, upsides and downsides to every technology. And one of the downsides here in growing up slowly and in teens just not being out of the house as much is that they, yes, in some ways, many of them end up not prepared for the situations that they enter once they become adults.
Well, we've already got the phone lines lighting up, so let me go to our first call. Virag in San Jose. Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, that's me.
Great. What's your question?
So I have teenage kids, and what I noticed was, and I've been noticing this for a couple of years, you're talking about face-to-face action. When they get together, they're not actually talking to each other. They're all on their phones or their iPads, and we've been trying to, you know, take them away. If you guys get together at a party, you know, interact with each other, do things, and they're like, oh, no, everyone has their phone. Like, no, take. So, and it's kind of a hard effort because even when they get together, they're actually on their phone.
Virag, interesting point. I've seen this too, Jean Twenge. What can be done about this? Just basically saying, if you go hang out, don't use your phones?
I know, you know, I mean, that's the other thing that's so interesting is, you know, these surveys document just how often you get to getting together with your friends, but they don't ask about, are you on the phone all the time, even when you're with your friends in person? So that like adds another level. It probably makes the differences even bigger and the trends even bigger than they actually are. So I think this all gets around to the general question of, okay, if smartphones are having this effect, what should we do about it? So I don't think the solution, especially for older teens, you know, 16 and up, is to take the smartphones away because they obviously are using them to communicate. Social media is kind of mandatory these days in high school. But moderation, nothing wrong with that. And you look at the mental health effects, they tend to show up after 2 or more hours a day of use. So that's more, in my view anyway, that's more than enough time to set up some things with your friends, communicate a little on social media, send some texts and so on. But then after that, if that phone is kind of super glued to your hand and taking it to bed with you at night, which is what a lot of teens, even some adults do, these limits, you know, have to come in. And in a party like that, yeah, you should be interacting face to face. That's your time to do that. So at some schools, they're saying, well, you got to put your phone in a bin. And at parties, a lot of teens actually think this is a good idea, that maybe have a party and everybody puts their phone away.
Well, Kate writes, it's not just younger people. I can't go to a movie, a class, or a performance without even older people checking their phones, disturbing others with noises and lit screens, and everybody is tentative about everything now and rude. It's interesting Kate writes this because I caught myself just the other day. I went to my daughter's piano lesson, and I found myself looking at my phone and reading the news while I was listening to her piano lesson and justifying this to myself because I needed to do it for work. And then also that, well, I was listening, right? But I do think it has a lot to do with what we model in front of our kids.
Absolutely. We're all in this together. This is affecting adults as well. You know, it affects iGen more because these are their formative years, but there are plenty of adults who have that phone in their hand 24/7 too. So I think that limit setting should absolutely, you know, be something adults should think about too. It's not just something you should do for your teens. You have to be conscious of how much you're on that phone, because you think about it, you have that phone in your hand. That is not a way to be present in your own life. And it's not just mental health and happiness. It's just taking in the world around you and not having that always be on the phone.
Well, Irma writes, "My world is not my mom's world, and my child's world is different as well. You cannot compare or have the same expectations." It's an interesting point, Jean Twenge, because it always seems like the previous generation thinks the next generation is awful. And you have some, you know, pretty strong language, things like they're on the brink of a mental health crisis. And even the title of your Atlantic piece was whether or not phones were destroying a generation. So,
which I didn't write, by the way.
Well, do you agree with it to some degree? I mean, just because the language is strong as well in your book. And I guess the question is are we just, you know, freaking ourselves out too much?
So this conclusion about iGen being on the brink of a mental health crisis doesn't come from older people. It comes from iGen themselves saying they're crying out for help. These results are based on, in my case, in the research that I do, surveys of 11 million teens and young adults that go back in some cases to the 1960s. They're based on national screening studies. They're based on CDC data on suicide rates. This is what young people are telling us. And that's really the purpose of the book, is to listen to young people and see what they have to say. So I think that's I've heard this argument before about, oh, you know, every generation thinks the other way. But I've always been very confused by it, because when you're looking at survey data of teens now versus teens 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago, that's not what you're doing. You're not surveying older people. It's not observational. It's about young people themselves and listening to them. So I also did a bunch of open-ended survey responses and in-depth interviews, because that's what we need to do. We need to find out what they have to say.
Well, let's hear from more of our listeners. Claire in Napa. Hi, Claire.
Oh, hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I just wanted to make a point, really, about Seesaw. I don't know if you know about this software, but it's a social media platform for schools. And I have a third and a fifth grader who because I agree, actually, with the subject we're discussing, that, you know, there's too much of this social media, particularly for younger children. And I was a little disappointed when I got back to school this year to discover that Seesaw, which is a social media platform that includes expectations that children will take video presentations of themselves and like and comment on each other's in class. And I'm, you know, as a parent who's tried to keep my children off social media, I feel pretty disappointed that the schools have kind of pulled the rug out from under me.
Claire, great story in terms of illuminating and illustrating a challenge. Jean Twenge, your thoughts?
I'm curious what age Seesaw is intended for.
Do you know, Claire?
Well, I do know that my third and fifth grader both are using it now in school.
Right, but yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know exactly which age they're intended for, but
yeah, so that's pretty young. We have that in my oldest is 10, and in fourth grade they had a few things in third grade where they would do video presentations and so on. You know, I think a little bit of this is fine. It's and this is where it kind of ran into trouble in my daughter's class as well, is when they're commenting on each other's videos, that it's a little young to start that process. When they get a little bit older, then that's good. They can maybe learn in a safe environment, hey, you know, don't say anything here that you wouldn't say to somebody's face, which is a very good lesson, say, for middle schoolers. But it is a difficult thing when you're trying to limit technology, and then in the classroom, they're bringing in some of it. But having a little bit of exposure, again, that moderation is fine. And then it's a lot of times the use is so high in the leisure time hours. And there, as a parent, you do have more control over that.
Well, what also makes it hard is that a lot of social media features are designed to keep us on our phones. I mean, the pings and notifications. So that's also another thing that I think teens are up against. And it's interesting, you have highlighted though technology has caused some of these problems, solutions that have been presented, like apps that can limit parents, kids' phone time that parents can use.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think the first key is, well, these days, the average age for a kid getting his or her first smartphone is age 10, which is really way too young to be able to have any self-control and the emotional resources to deal with it. So putting that off a little bit longer, because the mental health effects tend to be stronger for the younger teens, that's the first step. And then once your teen does get the phone, it doesn't have to be something where you just hand it to them and then they can do whatever they want and whenever they want. You can limit the amount of time the phone will work. Say, shut it off when they're supposed to be sleeping. You can also limit the amount of time that they're on certain apps. And I think that's the real key, that teens can use this technology to stay connected, but that there are limits set so it doesn't reach that level of addiction. Because that's the other thing we haven't talked about yet. There's an increasing amount of research suggesting that social media and smartphones overall are an addictive technology, that they involve some of the same brain chemicals and brain areas as drug addiction. And the way people talk about their phones, so including some of the young adults who I interviewed, that's how they talk about it. They say, well, I don't really want to, but I feel like I have to. They talk about it in the way a drug addict talks about drugs.
You describe some teens who sleep with their phones because it's comforting.
Exactly. And I think when it reaches that stage, that is a red flag for a bunch of reasons. First, that indicates, you know, a potential level of addiction. Second, pretty much all of the young adults who I talked to about this said that their smartphone was the last thing they saw before they went to sleep at night. It was the first thing they saw when they woke up in the morning. And almost all of them said they kept it on their bedside table because it was their alarm clock. And some of them said it was on. And if they woke up in the middle of the night, they would look at the phone. Well, sure enough, teens are now sleeping less. That actually might be one of the biggest reasons why these mental health effects showed up. It's probably another mechanism because staring at that phone with that blue light shining into your eyes has these physiological effects on your brain not making enough melatonin. Plus, it's very stimulating. You see something you don't agree with, or you didn't get enough likes, or have that testy chat exchange right before bed. None of this is conducive to good sleep and rest.
We're talking with San Diego State University psychology professor Gene Twenge about the effect of smartphones on the generation that has only known life with the internet, which she calls iGen. Twenge is concerned they're on the brink of the worst mental health crisis in decades. She's been studying generational differences for 25 years, and the generation she focuses on was born between 1995 and 2012. If you have questions for Gene Twenge, join the conversation by calling 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. You can post comments on Facebook, or you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Kraft. More with Gene Twenge after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Gene Twenge about her new book, iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and what that means for the rest of us. Her previous books include Generation Me and The Narcissism Epidemic. And again, you can join our conversation by calling 866-733-6786 or posting your comments on our website, on Facebook, on Twitter, or emailing us forum@kqed.org. Let's go right to the phones. Akshay in San Francisco. Hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So my question is, I think there were a lot of strong claims made here on the program, but everything that I heard sounded much more correlative than causative.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about what makes you say that there's a direct causal relationship between the use of smartphones and depression or other mental health problems.
Actually, thank you. Gene Twenge, are you drawing a straight line? Is this a causal relationship?
So that's a great question. So obviously, when you're looking at trends over time, it is very difficult to prove causation because you can't do a true experiment. You can't randomly assign one person to be born in, you know, a group of people to be born in 1985 and the other to be born in 1995. That's just not possible. So when you see trends over time, you have to take another approach. You can say, well, have these things changed at the same time? And here the answer is yes. And then are these things related among individuals? So yes, the analyses that I did were correlational. So that means, for example, that those who spent more time on social media were also those who were more likely to say they were unhappy. But, of course, it's possible that the unhappy teens spent more time on social media rather than social media causing unhappiness. However, there's three studies by other researchers that do a pretty good job ruling out that alternative explanation. Two follow people over time and found that those using social media more led to unhappiness, but unhappiness did not lead to more social media use. Another was a true experiment and randomly assigned people to either give up Facebook for a week or not. And those who gave up Facebook ended the week happier, less depressed, and less lonely than those who continued their normal use. So none of this is 100% experiment because that just can't be done. But there's a good amount of evidence pointing in that direction. The other part, too, is if it wasn't smartphones or if it was, say, unhappiness leading to more smartphone use, then you would have to say that there was something else that caused unhappiness and depression to spike right around 2012. And then that would lead to more smartphone use. It seems a lot more likely that more smartphone use led to unhappiness and depression because I have yet to hear, another possible cause for such a sudden change right around 2012 in teens' mental health.
Well, actually, thanks for the call. And Dan's not convinced. He writes, it's growing pains. We're transitioning into the next millennium and smartphones are just a link in the chain. Amy writes, is there a TED Talk or YouTube video directed at kids to convey these messages about the value of in-person interactions and non-screen activities? I have a 13-year-old daughter who spends more time on screen than I think is good, but she seems uninterested in my advice about it.
Yep. So I don't have one of those yet, but I'm sure that there are other organizations that do that talk about moderate screen time, and that might be a good resource.
Well, Kara asks, I've told my son, who's 12 and in seventh grade, that he may not have a smartphone at this time. We're in the minority. Most of his friends have iPhones. We live in a privileged area, and parents have no trouble buying their kids $800 phones and place no limits on their usage. Our solution, he has a flip phone, only for emergencies. I get more and more resistance as time goes on. How do you suggest discussing the benefits of this policy with our preteen? That comes up a lot. I mean, there are other points that I'm seeing from listeners just about, look, you know, it's part of growing up. How do you, when everybody else has a phone and it's linked to so much social interaction, how do you take that away?
Yeah. And so it's tough with 11 and 12 year olds. So my oldest is going to turn 11 soon. And she's in fifth grade. She's already one of the few kids who has a phone. And this is across neighborhoods, by the way. Smartphone has really collapsed the internet gap across social classes because even in disadvantaged neighborhoods, most kids have smartphones as well and spend plenty of time online. So this is something that many people are facing this dilemma. So I think you should. I love the flip phone idea. That's what I'm going to do for my daughter when she goes off to middle school, though we may put off even that. But once it gets to the point where the kid's like, look, I'm the only one, then that's a tough decision to make. I think once a kid's maybe 14, so in high school, I think it's fine to get the smartphone. But the mental health effects are stronger. The links are stronger for the younger teens in terms of more screen time leading to more being correlated with more unhappiness. So I think it is something parents need to be more cautious about. But if you do decide to go ahead and get him a smartphone, you can do that, but limit the amount of time he's on it through one of those apps. Have it shut down at night. Have rules in your house about when it can be used and when it can't. So, because that moderate use up to maybe 2 hours a day doesn't show the mental health effects, even for the younger teens. So it's really moderate use that's the key.
Well, let's hear from more callers. Let's hear from Dan in Sacramento. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My wife and I raised five sons, and they have graduation dates of between 2001 and 2013. And, of course, in those years, there was, you know, development of social media and whatnot. But the difference between my youngest son and the oldest son was in 2013 when he graduated from high school. I can't tell you how many of his friends and their families lost their houses, parents lost their jobs. There were a lot of divorces going on. Now, I realize this might be a microcosm in Sacramento, but to me, the difference was this. It was startling, and I was wondering if the effects of the Great Recession and the housing bust were taken into account in the research on this.
Dan, great question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a great question. So I thought about that a lot, about the economic effects. So, for example, in my book, in iGen, there's a graph with the unemployment rate. You have to try to find ways to capture the state of the economy, and that's one view of how well the economy is doing is the unemployment rate. So the unemployment rate peaked in 2010 and then has steadily improved since then. Teens' mental health shows exactly the opposite pattern. It does just fine until about 2011 or 2012, and then between 2012 and 2015, 2016, that's when it gets bad. So the trends don't fit for the economy. The economy has been improving and improving considerably over the time that teens' mental health has been deteriorating. I think the other important point is these trends with negative mental health effects are showing up for eighth graders. Eighth graders, what's going to affect them the most is what they're doing with their friends, what they're doing at school, how they're spending their time. And by far the biggest change in teens' day-to-day lives was the advent of the smartphone. I hate to be sarcastic about it, but I just really doubt that eighth graders are thinking about the shrinking middle class. Certainly many of them are affected by, you know, their parents being out of work and the housing crisis and so on. But that was improving by the time teens' mental health started to deteriorate around 2012.
Well, respond to Chris's point. He says, I can't speak entirely to iGen, but as a millennial, it seems like you're missing a chunk of the conversation when it comes to depression and anxiety. With my social circle, who are all college graduates, a lot of the existential crises come from the current economic market. We live paycheck to paycheck, so even when we do have a little extra scratch, we don't have the motivation or energy to go out and do things. And quite a number of us have two jobs. To attribute all of it to the cell phone seems like easy scapegoating.
Well, I absolutely agree that there's a lot of economic issues showing up with the changing job market with young adults. But in these particular analyses, we're looking at 13-year-olds, 12-year-olds. They have not entered the job market. They're not college graduates. These are not the forces that are affecting them. Those may be the forces that are affecting young adults, but these are trends showing up among very young teens, where that's not even on their radar screen.
And again, we're talking with Jean Twenge. Her book is iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Patricia in Albany, good morning.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is this. You've alluded to it a bit already, but not totally. How do your conclusions address the issues of people of different income groups? Particularly, I work with a lot of people who are very low income and, for example, don't even have computers at home. Also, how does it change in terms of racial and ethnic groups, the conclusions, if at all? And also in terms of whether the children were immigrants or their parents were immigrants, particularly low-income immigrants. And also in terms of doing focus groups, needing to do focus groups in different languages. So were you able to capture that experience?
Patricia, thank you.
Yeah, so the great thing about these national surveys that that I draw from in this research is that they're nationally representative. So that means the survey administrators have very carefully made sure that teens from background are represented. Low income to high income, every region of the country, race and ethnicity, immigrants versus not, and so on. So I was able to look at whether these trends appeared across socioeconomic statuses, across regions, gender, race, and they do. They appear across every social class, all the trends in growing up slowly, the trends in mental health, the trends in technology use. The smartphone has really collapsed the internet gap in terms of social class, except for maybe the very poorest teens. They almost all have a smartphone. It's about 90% right now have a smartphone by the time they're high school seniors. The only real exception to that is gender, that these mental health issues are increasing more among girls than among boys. But that's really the only demographic difference that shows up in these trends. Otherwise, these trends show up across the board.
Well, Patricia, thanks for the call. Why girls and how do they affect them differently?
So it's the why question is always a little harder to nail down with this. But we know from many different sources that these trends are more pronounced for girls. That's, say, in the suicide rate and depressive symptoms and so on. And why exactly that is my best guess is because girls spend more time on social media, and because the way girls historically have interacted with each other has been more social and more verbal. And that's what goes on smartphones and on social media, as opposed to boys, when they are bullying each other or getting into fights. It's more physical. It's more in person. YGen spends less time with each other in person, more time on the phone. And that's often the environment which can be negative for girls' mental health in terms of exclusion and in terms of bullying.
Jean Twenge, what do you mean when you say in your title that these kids are growing up more tolerant?
So if you think about the world iGen has grown up in, many of them will not even remember a time before same-sex marriage was legal in this country. They really take it for granted that people should be who they are. And that's how they see sexual orientation. Not as much transgender, I found, because they have a hard time reconciling that fundamental individualism in the way they see the world with transgender. So there's still some progress to be made there. But overall, in terms of race and gender and sexual orientation, iGen has a real bedrock sense of equality and is more supportive of equality across groups than previous generations were at the same age. I did find that in terms of race and gender, if you look at the generations right now, there's not as much of a generation gap. Older people, older generations have changed their views as well. Where there's still a noticeable generation gap is around LGBT issues. That's where iGen and young millennials really stand out in their support.
Mm. The reason I ask is because you spoke with KQED's John Sepulvedo after the deadly Charlottesville protest, and you mentioned that those younger than 24 are showing a lot of prejudice when he spoke with you. And so I was curious how that squares with your more tolerant
conclusion. For the most part, the majority are showing more tolerance. What's interesting is there are a few places where there hasn't been as much progress. So one of them is in terms of embracing a diverse environment. So there's a question on these big surveys that asks about an environment with people of many races. Is that desirable? And responses to that have barely budged since the 70s. Plus, about 15%, even now, 2015 data for iGen 18-year-olds, 15% say they actually prefer, of white teens, say they prefer a same-race environment. So it's not zero, it's not 5%, 15%, which is a minority, but it's higher than many people would expect.
Well, let's hear from more listeners. Hamel in San Ramon. Hi, Hamel.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so I have a slightly different spin and it's completely hypothetical, but I am a father of three daughters, all born in this century. They are 16 and 13, 16 and 12. And I was recently on their birthday wondering what are the challenges for this next generation? And I wrote a little piece on one of their Facebook. I want to get your opinion on that. I was wondering what mountains they are going to conquer, where they are going to go, the limits that their parents have never thought existed, just like all generations in past have found new areas to work on. And I think I'm beginning to see, again, this is completely hypothetical, and it is not just iPhones and Alexa, though it is enabled by that. And the answer, I think, is in handling information. This is the age of information overload. With all claims of scientific method, I still find myself falling too often for confirmation bias, believing pictures and words that agree with what I want to believe. But not these kids. There isn't a YouTube video or a meme or a GIF that they have not already seen. I think they are not fooled by the dress colors and whether something is gold and blue or white and black. They have access to conflicting information before they form opinions,
yes.
Humongous amount of opinion. And I think they instinctively look at both sides. I think they are going to, what is scientific method to us is going to be common sense to them. They are going to be much better at handling this.
Emil, forgive me. We get your point, and I think you're raising a big question. But he's talking, I think, also just about the big challenge of being able to evaluate the information that comes at this generation. Gene Twenge.
Right. I mean, that's a problem for everybody. Obviously with the conversation in the last year about how many people are believing fake news stories and so on and how that may have had an influence on the election. I mean, this is not just a question for teens. It's a question for all of us, given the amount of information and its accessibility. So, again, there's trade-offs. There are wonderful things about having access to so much information and being a more democratic process that it's so much easier for people to post things and to write blogs and share their opinion and so on. But that also makes it easier for people to get information that's false. And we can hope that this generation becomes more skilled at being able to sort those things out. It has not, at least so far, made them less polarized than the rest of us. For example, the percentage of both high school seniors and entering college students who are at the extremes of the political spectrum, either far right or far left, is at all-time highs. So they're politically polarized just like the rest of us.
Well, Laura writes, I think it's imperative that parents set the example of a healthy relationship with phones and other technology as well as social media. It's likely that kids are glued to their phones because they see their parents glued to their phones. So often I'm at the park with my kids and see other parents staring at a phone instead of engaging with their child. Nance writes, I think another big problem with kids not growing up is helicopter parenting. Mia asks, I appreciate the idea that we're all in this together, but where does that end? Is it just parents and schools that need to figure this out? Or do the tech companies that created these amazing tools share some responsibility? What has their response been to your article? And given that this is potentially a growing public health crisis, is this a call to action for everyone?
Well, what I think is particularly interesting is that many people in the tech industry have come out and said that they limit their own children's access to these devices and that they are concerned about their effects on kids. So right after the iPad came out in 2010, a journalist interviewed Steve Jobs and said, I bet your kids love this. And he said, no, they haven't tried it. We limit the amount of time our kids spend on screens. Melinda Gates recently wrote a piece in the Washington Post reflecting on her experience with her three children and how she is concerned about the amount of time teens are spending with these technologies. So I think there is awareness in Silicon Valley about these issues. I think the problem is that the more time people spend on their phones, the more time they spend on social media sites, the more money companies make. So they are in a difficult position because they benefit from people using these technologies in a way that isn't moderate, in a way that's not limited. They're best off if everybody's on them 12 hours a day or more. And so I'm not sure there'll be any action from that quarter, although I can be hopeful. In some ways, it would be against their best interests.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Gene Twenge, San Diego State University psychology professor who's been studying generational differences for 25 years and who says the effect of smartphones on the generation that has only known life with the internet is on the brink of a mental health crisis. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim in for Michael Krasny today. And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Casey in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Casey.
Hi, thanks, Nina. Good morning, Gene. I been listening, and I have kids that are over 20, and I have two young ones that are 8 and 10, and I've been watching the trend towards slower maturation and a slower approach into adulthood for a while. What I'm wondering about is how do you see the crisscross between that phenomenon and the opposing phenomenon of the demand for early specialization among kids, both in all kinds of disciplines, sports, music, dance, academics, that sort of thing. How do you see those interacting, those dynamics?
Thanks, Casey.
Yeah, interesting question. Yeah, it's true. In some ways, we're asking kids to grow up sooner because we want to say, okay, you're going to start soccer at 2.
Right.
And then we want you to stick with that. And, you know, decide so early, you know, what sport they're going to play or what they're going to specialize in. And there's some, interesting play between these trends that, you know, some of this kind of goes hand in hand. They're kind of two sides of the same coin in a way, because one of the reasons we expect that specialization is because we're looking, as parents, we're looking toward that college application from an early age. And that's a new thing. College didn't used to be the seemingly mandatory experience that it is now, at least for middle-class families. So some of it is actually probably coming from the same trends toward having fewer kids, nurturing them more carefully, expecting they're going to go to college, and that this time for, you know, formulating who they are is going to take a little bit longer, but they have to start earlier, you know, making themselves, a good candidate for college, even though I think that does affect mostly the younger kids, because in terms of homework and extracurricular activities, high school seniors, entering college students, aren't spending any more time on those than they did 10 or 20 years ago. So it's not that is their sole focus, but that it starts sooner is an interesting trend.
Well, let me thank Casey for the question and go to Marcus in San Francisco. Hi, Marcus.
Yeah, hi. I had a quick question. Have there been any studies done on children whose parents specifically do not get them smartphones at such an early age?
Marcus, thanks. That's definitely a question I had Gene Twenge about that. Are there any studies on this?
I don't know of any studies on that. I think it would be very interesting to look into that. I mean, from these surveys, we can say for sure that let's take 12th graders, high school seniors, those who don't have a phone at all by 17 or 18 are not particularly happy, which makes some sense. They're probably the ones who are already marginalized in high school. That is not really a good scene. But those who text a little bit, are on social media a little bit, that tends to be the sweet spot for happiness and mental health. So I think especially for those older teens, those who don't have a phone don't look particularly great, and they're probably not having a great experience. It's having that phone and having the limited use that seems to be the best.
Well, Gene Twenge, I know we spent a lot of this hour talking about the problematic nature of these smartphones, but how do you respond to people who feel like they've actually improved their relationships in terms of social interaction, that the texting helps people feel close and connected during the day? Do you have a response to that? I have some parents who've said that about their teen kids.
Sure. And, you know, I'm sure it does have that effect, you know, particularly for, you know, parents and children. In some ways, it can make people feel closer. But for a lot of teens, the key relationship is with their friends. And right around 2012, that's when more of them started to say that they felt left out and lonely. So at least in terms of those peer relationships, it doesn't seem to be resulting in a feeling of closer social connection, even though perhaps it might be between parents and children.
Well, let me see if I can squeeze in one last call from Vanessa in San Francisco. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi. I want to thank you so much for your article. I loved the article you wrote for The Atlantic. My question is, your opinion on the responsibilities of school districts, because as it stands in San Francisco, tech policies are site-based, so there will be some principles to allow free, unrestricted use of iPhones during lunchtime, and as it turns out, school-provided iPads for those kids whose parents, like myself, did not want to buy my 11-year-old an iPhone. The school provides iPads and unrestricted use at lunchtime. So what's happening is some of the schools at lunchtime, you'll see kids, you know, not socializing but using their phones. And then some schools who have decided, principals have decided to regulate them based on wanting the kids to socialize and not have technology be part of their education time at school. And it's considering social interaction part of a healthy school environment. I wondered, do you think the school district does not have a standardized policy on this? So each principal makes their own decision in San Francisco. And I wondered what your feelings were on that.
Vanessa, thanks. Jean Twenge, in the seconds we have left.
And, you know, one of the teens I interviewed, one of the most poignant things any of the teens I interviewed said to me was one who said, I sit at lunch and everybody else is on their phone and it makes me feel so lonely. That's the problem. So it would be great, I think, if there were a more uniform policy because, yeah, let's have at least some time for the kids to interact with each other face to face.
Jean Twenge, is this generation going to be okay? Are they going to be okay ultimately?
You know, there's so many great things. They're so safe. They have a stronger work ethic. We didn't even get into to that discussion. But I think they need to have that more moderate use of phones. And if they can do that, this is obviously a generation with a tremendous amount of potential.
Jean Twenge, her book is iGen. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
I'm Mina Kim. Thanks to our listeners for all their great questions. Have a great day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.